Okay, good morning, everybody. So, the lecture today should take somewhere over an hour, and then for the second half, the demonstrator, Daniele Tefani, will come in and talk to you a bit about the assignment, the simulation assignment, give you some hints about where to start. I won't be able to record that, so if you're off campus, please feel free to contact Daniele sort of on a one-to-one basis. I'll post his email address today sometime. Okay, but returning to the sort of theory of simulation, the last time I met with you, we discussed output analysis. So we had built our simulation, and we were able to observe event traces. And so we talked a bit about sort of how you, what sort of information you try and collect, how you collect it. Usually what we're looking for is the estimate of some sort of statistical parameter, like the mean, the average waiting time, the average number of people in a queue, etc. Other ones, variance, percentile, etc. Okay. And we observed that it was difficult to say anything meaningful about sort of a single run of data, but that if we took a number of runs, then things became a lot nicer for us. We could assume something about our estimations. You know, typically, if you take the mean, you would have a sample mean for each run, and you know, these were randomly distributed. But if you had enough of them, you could assume something about the distribution. Okay, and this led us to our idea of confidence intervals, where our estimate was a random variable. It was the observation of a random variable, but we could reason about how close that estimate was to the actual value. Okay, and since it is the observation of a random variable, you can't say for certain, but you could associate a percentage with it. And so what you got with the confidence interval was, well, you have your estimate, and then you had two numbers. One was an interval around the estimate, and then you also had a probability that your actual value lay within that interval, and you'd want that to be like 95 or 98%. Okay. And then we talked about some of the sort of details about how you would gather samples, and so you could, you know, again, run individual runs. You could break runs up into segments and gather your statistics along each segment. If you did that, you might run into the problem of segments being correlated with each other, and we had a quick look about how you calculate what that correlation is and how you feed that back into how you adjust your estimates if they do show correlation. Now, what we're going to look at today is input modeling, and there are a lot of similarities between this and what we're going to reason about and say, and the idea of a confidence interval. But there will be some, obviously some differences as well, which we'll get into as we go along. Okay, so the same references should do, Harry Peros and Jerry Banks. This more than the other topics, I've sort of rearranged a bit, sort of in a way that I think is a little more straightforward. So, the idea here is the question of how do we determine what the input for our model should be. Okay. And one option is that, well, we just, think about it and come up with a mathematical model. Okay. And a second method is that we do have some observation of typical input for the type of system we're building. So if you're talking about telephone network, there's loads of data about telephone network usage. And so if we think of having samples of actual data, we can ask the question, essentially, of how do we mathematically model those? How do we fit those samples to some random distribution? And why would we want to do that? Well, again, once you have this random distribution, you can generate as many new samples as you want. You don't have to go back to the same old samples every time. Okay. And so again, the issue is we have an observed sample, and then we have some distribution that we think this sample is probably like. So again, what's our confidence that the sample, the underlying distribution of the sample is the one that we've chosen? Okay, and the bulk of today's lecture, or probably pretty much everything today, is looking at specific tests for getting that sort of getting that reassurance. Okay, and one of the most used tests is the chi-square test, and again, it's a way of comparing sample data to a random distribution. Okay. So we've already mentioned the chi-square test. We mentioned it in the context of how we at least attempted to confirm that random variables that we generated, or that we just went to Java and called the random number generator to generate. Again, how did we verify that those were uniformly distributed? Okay. And we also touched upon the idea of, again, taking real world data observations, and what we had discussed before was actually just constructing some distribution for them. If we sort of bend them into intervals, then we could just construct a distribution around those intervals. But again, another way of doing it is to try and fit our data to some well-known distribution. And again, that has a lot of benefits in terms of then being able to generate additional sort of sample data. But we want to have some confidence that there is some relationship to our observed data and our sample and our chosen distribution. Okay, and testing this is what's called a goodness of fit test, and So again, we are taking sample data, comparing it to some sort of distribution, and trying to reason about sort of how likely it is that this data actually is associated with this distribution. Now, the difference and what makes it a little bit sort of less satisfactory in terms of testing is that in the previous case, we actually knew what the distribution of our samples was. We had engineered the problem so that our sample data, again, roughly speaking, had a normal distribution. Okay, so we knew that. Here, we don't actually know what our underlying, what the distribution of our underlying sample data is. The question we're trying to ask is it the one that we've chosen? And so, again, we're going to associate some sort of probability with this question, what's the likelihood of it being, but there's a subtle difference in sort of what exactly we can confirm and reject. So the way I've structured the lecture today is that we're first going to look at the test and just sort of mechanically go through the test and see what the procedure is. And then I'm going to come back around and talk to you or sort of discuss what the exact and precise conclusions we can draw from doing this test is. Because it's not exactly what we actually do or what we actually assume or think of to begin with, although again we just sort of generalize. That's a bit vague, but hopefully sort of again by the end of the lecture it'll be a bit clearer. Okay. So we're going to start by having a closer look at applying the chi-square test to the question of testing a sample of data for uniformity, for a uniform distribution. And so we'll go through an example, again, where we perform the test, where we come to a conclusion. We'll then look at why the test might not be 100% reliable or why it might not be totally satisfactory. Again, we'll just do proof by example. We'll have a look at a couple examples. Then we'll have a look at applying the test to other distributions just to, again, not think that it all has to be compared to uniform. It is quite a general test. And finally, we'll come back around to have a look at exactly what we were testing for and where we might have sort of upon our first pass been a bit misled. Okay, so let's look at this problem of random numbers. Okay. And so we've discussed loads of ways of generating random numbers, some of which are more or less satisfactory. And then we mentioned that, if you don't know where your random numbers are coming from, you might want to actually test to make sure they were genuinely random. So what we're going to do now is actually run through the chi-square test. Okay, so we have a sample of numbers here. They run from somewhere between 0 and 1. And if you look at them, well, you know, they look as random as anything. But again, it's hard to tell just looking. There's 100, it's a 10 by 10 matrix, so there's 100 numbers there. It would be sort of hard to tell. Okay. So, we're going to apply our chi-square test to try and decide. So, basically, what the chi-square test is going to do is it's going to compare the frequency of occurrence in a number of intervals, sort of equal intervals. Because, again, if you have a uniform distribution, say between 0 and 1, and if you divide your region up into sort of sub-intervals, so here we've divided up into 2, or we can divide it up into 4, however many. If we looked at sufficient number of samples, we would expect roughly the same number of samples in each interval. Okay, that's just, it's a fairly obvious property of a uniform distribution. So, if we look at a sample of enough sort of length, so enough, if we take enough samples, then we would expect those samples to also exhibit this property. Okay, so we have our 100 samples. On average, there should be 25 samples, or there should be 25. If you pick 100 random numbers, on average, you'd expect 25 in each subsection. Now, since we're only taking a single sample, so one set of 100 drawn from all the possible sets of 100, you'd be very surprised if there was actually 25, 25, 25, 25. It might happen, but you know, it would be very lucky, very surprising. The question is then, if you have 24, 26, 23, 27, so slightly up and down on that figure, is that just due to sort of the randomness of any given sample, or is that indicative that probably the underlying distribution of that sample is not uniform? Okay. And so what the chi-square test does is it offers a comparison between what you'd expect and what you've observed, and it gives you a decision procedure for deciding if the variation is sort of normal, or not that normal is a loaded word, but to be expected just because of, you know, random variance, or whether, again, statistically it means that the sample was not distributed in the fashion that you're trying to prove it is. Okay. So we're comparing our sample to our observed sample. So what we need to do is we need to break our interval. So we're looking for uniform 0 to 1. So we need to break that interval into between 0 and 1 into a number of equal subintervals. For this problem, we've chosen 10 subintervals. Okay. What we would expect is that for each of those subintervals, you'd have an equal number of samples falling into each. So on average, you'd have 10 in each. And so again, that gives us our total of 100 samples. Again, our observation is not going to match that exactly, because again, we're just taking one sample through the system and it's random. So we can find out, so we can get the data for what is the frequency per interval for our sample. And so then we want to test to see whether that sample, or how that sample compares to what we expect. Okay. So the first thing you might think to look at is the sum of the differences. So again, the variation off the mean. And the problem with that, or the drawback of that, is obviously that the average difference is, or the sum of the differences is going to always be zero, because since there's a fixed number of samples, you have to deviate plus and minus, and those have to balance out. So one standard way of getting around this plus and minus thing would be to square your differences. So that's a fairly standard engineering technique. And there's no real harm in doing that, except we can observe that, in this one, it would actually be difficult to see any real problem with squaring the differences. The problem might come if your expected values per interval were not uniform. Okay. In that case, having the same difference or a greater, having the same difference might represent a greater or lesser deviation from the expected value. Okay, so if we look here in between 0.1 and 0.2, we have a difference of minus 2. But that's on an expectation of 4. So 4 plus or minus 2 is, that's a big difference. Here, however, we have an expectation between 0.5 and 0.6. We have an expectation of 26. And 26, or plus or minus 2, that's not as great, at least the percentage type of difference, and you might not be as worried about plus or minus 2 off of 26 as you would be plus or minus 2 off of 4. Okay. So the final step we take is to normalize our difference squared by our expected value. So we divide our difference squared by whatever value we would expect within that interval. Okay. So that gives you more of a reflection of the percentage difference rather than just raw difference. Or percentages, proportional difference rather than just a raw absolute difference. Okay. And so, for our example, if we just crunch out the numbers, we have, we have a number for each interval, and then we sum those numbers up, and that sum is our chi-square value. Okay, so this is the value we're using in our test. Okay. Now, again, our OIs are randomly distributed with some unknown distribution. This whole chi-squared value is randomly distributed, and it can be shown that the distribution is what's called a chi-square distribution. Okay, so it's not normal, but it again has some sort of specific distribution. Okay. Now, as with the student's t-test or distribution, the chi-square distribution is dependent on the degrees of freedom. And as you'll recall, the degrees of freedom is roughly related to your sample values. Specifically, it's the number of sample values that you would be free to assign. So if we return to this example, we could assign values for all of the first 9 intervals, but then since we know that it has to sum up to 100, our 10th interval would be fixed. So in this example, on anything with a uniform distribution, our degrees of freedom is going to be the number of samples minus 1. Okay. And so, again, as the degrees of freedom increases, the distribution looks more random, although that move towards random is sort of slower, and it's not quite as exact as it would be for, say, a student's t-test. Okay. So, as I said, the degrees of freedom is the number of samples or intervals minus 1, so you get 9. Okay, and now things again start looking a bit more like the confidence intervals. Here we choose a significance level. And typical values are 5%, 2%, 1%, 0.5%. And the significance level is the probability of ending up in this tail. Okay. And so here, if we choose a significance level, then we can choose a critical value, and that's the value at which sort of again, the probability of being greater than that value is our significance probability. We then compare our calculated chi-square value, so our sum OI minus EI squared over EI, and if that sum is greater than our critical value, we say that our sample is not uniformly distributed, and you always, again, have to say with a significance of whatever significance value you chose. Okay. If our calculated chi-square value is less than our critical value, we conclude that our sequence is uniformly distributed. Okay. So, returning to our example, we can choose a significance level of 5% and again take a look at the table. We have 9 degrees of freedom and a significance level of 5%. Our critical value then is 16.919. And again, we're going to compare our calculated chi-square value to that critical value. And obviously, in this case, our calculated value is 3.4, and that's a lot less than 16.919. Okay. And so the conclusion we reach is that our sequence is uniformly distributed with a significance level of 5%. Okay. So based on that test, we'd be happy to sort of use it as the basis of our random numbers. Okay. Now, again, certain assumptions are made when generating the chi-square distribution, so some care has to be taken in setting up your chi-square test, and in particular, we want to ensure that in general, we would expect to see a reasonable number of samples falling into any interval. Okay. So, in general, the test should be set up so that for all EI, your EI value is greater than 5. Okay. So, you would also want to have sort of sufficient degrees of freedom. And between the two, that means that you want to have a reasonable sample size, and then what your sample size is going to dictate how many intervals you can break your system into. So this is from Banks, but again, if you have 5 to 10, well, again, on average, you're going to have between 5 and 10. You're going to expect between 5 and 10 between any sample. Similarly here, and again, here this would give you more between 10 and 20 expected observations per sample. But again, it's nice to have lots of data. You don't always. Okay. And finally, note that the test can be sensitive to your choice of intervals. Obviously, the finer intervals you choose, the closer an approximation essentially you're making to your underlying distribution. So that something might show up with more intervals that wouldn't show up with less intervals. Okay. So, we've concluded that our numbers were randomly distributed. But, again, we can take a closer look at that assumption. Now, if we look at this set of numbers, it's the same set of individual samples. Okay, so exactly the same numbers are in this set, this 100 numbers, as in the 100 numbers for our original data. And so, applying the chi-square test, we are going to conclude that these samples are random. Okay. Now, think about these samples as a sequence. Think about the sequence running across the rows, one row after another. So we go 0.12, 0.21, 0.25, all the way up to 0.9, then back down to 0.22, 0.64, 0.70, 0.94, 0.2. Okay. Now, the question is, do these numbers look as random as your previous set of numbers? And might not be that obvious, just upon initial glance. But I've set up these numbers, so I've ordered these numbers across the row. So you always start at smallest number and march up to the largest number at every row. So you have a set of 10 increasing numbers, then another set of 10 increasing numbers, then another set of 10 increasing numbers. That doesn't feel as random as just having numbers all over the board. And again, probabilistically, that would be a very unusual sequence to observe. So there's obviously some problem with our chi-square test. We've made this conclusion. We're pretty positive about our conclusion just based on the chi-square test. But now, you know, there is something wrong. Okay. And so what we're going to do now is, again, we're not going to analyze what's wrong with our conclusion. We'll leave that till last. But we're just going to point out that the chi-square essentially tested one thing. It tested the frequency of occurrence, but it didn't at all look at all at the sequencing. And so there probably is some need to look at sequencing as well. Okay, and so again, Runge's tests were mentioned, and we'll take a little bit deeper look at Runge's tests now. And the idea of a Runge's test is, again, to examine the sequencing of numbers. And if you encounter too many runs, that can be a problem, or if you encounter too few runs, that can be a problem. So what we want to sort of try to reason about is how many runs is the right number to observe. Okay. Now, when we say runs, runs are just sequences that exhibit some property, and there's sort of two classes that we look at. We look at runs up and down, and again, that's sequences of increasing numbers and sequences of decreasing numbers. And then we might also want to look at runs above and below the mean. Okay. So you don't want to, again, have half the numbers above the mean, then drop down and have the second half of the sequence all below the mean. Again, that doesn't seem very random. Okay. And so the two things you can look at for runs are how many there are, and you can also look at the lengths of the runs. So, if we have a sequence of n numbers, then the maximum number of runs you can have is n minus 1. And so essentially the n minus 1 means they keep bouncing between increasing and decreasing. And the minimum you could have would be 1. Okay. And again, 1 would either be they're all increasing or they're all the numbers are decreasing. Okay. Now, what we can make an assertion about is what the the number of runs is again a random variable. So for any observation, you're going to get a different number. But we can describe the mean and the variance for that number, and that's in terms of the length of the sequence. Okay. And for n greater than 20, we can say that the A is approximately normally distributed. Okay, so what does that mean? Well, that means that you can compare your observed value of A, so the observed number of runs, to the normal distribution. And you can reason about how far away from the expected mean is your observed value. Okay. So, again, you have your normal distribution, and here's mu A. And whenever you take a sample, it's going to fall somewhere. And what we'd like to do is say it falls near mu A. And as always with normal distributions, what near means is quantified by the standard deviation. Okay. And so if we look at our second example, so this is the one where I've ordered all the numbers, then we can calculate what A is, we can calculate the variance, we know what our run count is, we have 10 runs all going up, and so 10 is not going to compare very favorably to 66. And again, if we look at how many standard deviations it is away from 66, we get is 13.4 standard deviations away from what we would expect the mean to be. And all I said about that was really unlikely. If you return to your table, your normals table, it doesn't even go out that far, because you know, you'd have a sort of a minuscule probability of being sort of that far away. Okay. So, If we encountered this situation, we would conclude, despite the chi-square test, that we had a problem. Okay. So, runs above and below the mean. Again, they're pretty straightforward in terms of what it means. You obviously, how many numbers are above, how many numbers are below, how many runs do you get out of that? Okay. And as for runs up and down, we can calculate what our expected number of runs would be. Okay. And this is now done in terms of the number of entries above and below, which is observed. But you get, that should be at a capital N on the bottom there. And so you can calculate the mean and the variance. And again, if either your runs up or your runs above or runs below are greater than 20, this is going to be approximately a normal distribution. And you can do your calculations again, seeing how close your observed value is to the expected value. Okay. The final test that you can do is on run length. And so, what you want to do is have some idea of how many runs of a certain length you can expect in a sequence of n numbers, and that's going to differ depending on what sort of runs test you're doing, runs up and down or runs above and below the mean. I'll list it later, but it's a bit long. Okay, and naturally, you can define an expected value for how many you would expect above and below, or up and down, okay, of length I. You can also observe how many you have of length I, and then, again, use the chi-square test to compare what you observed to what you would expect. Okay. Now, again, the actual values that you would get for the expectation are a bit complicated. This is getting into territory. I wouldn't actually ask you to reproduce this on an exam. But again, just be aware that you can calculate it sort of depending on what you're trying to go for. So in each of these cases, then, we have a test that will sort of, again, give us an answer as to whether our runs have the appropriate characteristics. Okay, so what we saw there was, well, how the chi-square test worked with the specific example of uniform distributions, a caveat for why we might not 100% trust the chi-square test, and for the case of uniform distributions, additional tests that would give us more confidence. It should be noted that the chi-square test can be applied to general distributions, so if you have some sample values which you have no reason to think are uniform, you can try to apply it to, you can try and decide using the chi-square test whether they adhere to some other distribution. Okay. And so the first thing you need to do there would be to determine what distribution you thought it likely that your data would adhere to. And this can be done, sort of, there's two basic techniques for doing this. Distributions, in general, are known to model sort of certain, it's sort of real phenomena. Okay, so you might say, well, what I have is something doing this, and I know that typically you'd use an exponential distribution to model that. Okay. The other option is to just do a sort of more general curve fitting, you know, roughly what the shape of the distribution is. You eye up the shape of your samples and say, well, they look similar enough. Let's see if that'll work. Okay. And so, whatever way you choose, you need to do two things. You need to estimate the parameters which characterize the distribution. So if all you have is a sample, well, if you want to compare it to an exponential distribution, it's going to be an exponential distribution with a specific value of lambda, so you'll have to calculate what lambda is based on your samples, but that's just, you know, a typical sample estimate. And then afterwards, you need to turn around and, again, test for goodness of fit. Does it really make sense to put the data against the specific distribution? Okay, so again, most distributions didn't arise just because they were cute mathematical formula, but they were sort of in response to trying to model real-world problems. And so if you think about binomials, that's sort of your coin flipping. And so it's the number of successes in n trials. Again, for a more technical example, it might be the number of defective components out of n, okay, where each one's equally likely to be defective. The Poisson process, again, models the number of events occurring in a fixed amount of time. And it's linked with the exponential process, so the two are sort of linked together, where the exponential is the time between the independent events, where the time is memoryless, so you would expect the time for Poisson to have this exponential property, and you would expect the number of the number of events according to this exponential to be Poisson distributed. So the two of them go hand in hand. And again, I'm sure that Connor by this point has gotten into queuing theory and the use of Poisson and exponential within queuing theory. Okay. And one thing to say about that is it tends to be, again, heavily leaned on as a distribution because it's fairly tractable, whether or not it's actually a good fit or not. Okay, normal distribution is, again, the sum of a bunch of independent distributions. And so that could be if you have a number of steps in an assembly process, what's the time taken overall? And, you know, again, you can go on. There's any basic probability book you pick up will sort of discuss all the different distributions and where they come from. Okay. So, for the distributions, again, you need to estimate relevant parameters. So if you, for instance, had a uniform distribution, you'd have to, or wanted to fit to a uniform distribution, you'd have to ask the question, well, what's the range of that distribution? Okay, and typically you would base that on your sample size and then give yourself a little bit of a cushion beyond that. Okay. If you're dealing with exponentials, again, the key parameter is lambda, which is a rate, which is just 1 over the mean. Okay. So, once you've then calculated the parameters, you would model, you would try and, you would use the chi-square test to see how close your sample data fell against your chosen distribution. Okay. So again, we have some set of numbers here, and in this case, we pick an exponential distribution. Yeah, it turns out not to be the right one, but we just decided to check it. And so we want to, first of all, estimate our parameters and then use the chi-square test to compare the distribution to our sample data. And we have our CDF is 1 minus e to the minus lambda x. Lambda is estimated as 1 over the sample mean. And so you can throw those numbers into Excel or whatever and get that your sample mean is 11.9 roughly, and 1 over that is 0.084. Okay. Now, you have to be a little more careful in selecting intervals when you're not dealing with the uniform distribution, because again, uniform was nice because we expected roughly the same amounts of occurrences in each. If you think about something that's non-uniform, well, you might have a tail where you're only expecting sort of the odd occurrence. Now, if you try to divide things up evenly, you're going to get sort of a lot of occurrences in some parts and only the very odd one in another. And if you recall, one of the conditions of using chi-square was that we wanted to keep our expected occurrences greater than 5. Okay. So, in order to do this, what we do is we modify our interval size so that we get roughly, we would expect either roughly, depending on your distribution, or the way we're going to do it, the exact same number of occurrences in each interval. And so what that means is you're going to have a big long interval sort of at the end, and again, smaller intervals here in the middle where, you know, the occurrences are more frequent. Okay, or, well, that's not an exponential distribution, but so we can look at our CDF, and we sort of, again, somewhat randomly chose 8 intervals, and we want equal probability of falling into any of the intervals, and so we can compare that probability to the CDF. And so for each I times P is 1 minus e to the minus lambda AI. AI is going to be the endpoints of your intervals. And so again, what we're trying to do is to pick these endpoints so that in each interval we pick up a probability of P of being in that interval. Okay. And so, in this case, that's pretty easy. You can just sort of solve for AI. You'd move the one over, so you could, well, and get rid of the minus sign, so you get 1 minus IP equals e to the minus lambda AI. Take the natural log of both sides, and then divide out the lambda. Okay. So we get an interval length. Again, the AIs are not falling at some fixed multiple of a number, but are sort of increasing in size as we go along. Okay. And so if we take our 8 intervals and plug in, these are the values we get. And again, our last interval is of infinite length. It's greater than 24. Again, the expected number of occurrences is now uniform. And then we can go through and count the number of occurrences for our test. Okay. And we get, if we go ahead and sort of calculate our chi-square number, we get this rather large number of 39.6. Okay, now to apply the test, again, we're going to refer to our tables. We're going to pick a significance and compare to the critical value. Now, one thing to note here, when we're looking at our degrees of freedom, we have 6 degrees of freedom. Now, as I said before, the degrees of freedom is how many values for our observations we could feel free to just randomly assign. And if you know the mean, well, that's fixing one of them, because the mean is a function of these 10 values. And so if you have 9 of them in the mean, you can solve for the 10th. Now, because of the properties of the exponential, once you know the mean, you also know the variance. Okay. So that's a second equation. And so if you have 2 equations, that means you can pick 2. And if you left 2 unknown, you could solve for those 2. So 2 values are actually fixed in this case. Okay. And so that means that our degrees of freedom are n minus 2, or 6. Okay, we'll choose our same significance level of 5% and see what happens. Again, we have 6 degrees of freedom, and going over to the 5% significance level, we get this value of 12.592. Although, again, it doesn't really matter what value you pick, you're never going to get up to 39. So we compare our calculated value to our critical value, and we conclude that our sample is not exponentially distributed. Okay, so again, that covers how chi-square testing is used. This last topic of hypothesis testing is sort of an examination of, again, what conclusions should we be drawing from using the chi-square test, rather than what conclusions we actually do go ahead and draw. And it's worth looking at the terminology, just because, again, it puts it into the framework where we can discuss why there's sort of a bit of uncertainty in using something like a chi-square test. Okay. So, a hypothesis, again, is just some sort of assumption that we make about our system that we want to prove. So the assumption we have been making all day here is that our sample values are drawn from a certain distribution. Okay. Now, null hypothesis is just a bit of terminology. It's, you know, it's just a type of hypothesis, and it's essentially, in statistics, it's one where sort of everything's just going along fine. There's nothing unusual or out of the ordinary is happening. So again, the usual is that our sample is drawn from the distribution that we want it to be. So you'll just see it referred to as hypothesis, and sometimes you'll see an assumption like that referred to as a null hypothesis. Don't panic, it doesn't really mean a lot. Okay. Typically we're going to denote the hypothesis by H0. Again, we'll see why in a second. Okay. And what we need to be able to do is to reason about our hypothesis. And so a hypothesis test is some procedure that leads us to accept or reject our hypothesis. Okay. And again, since we're talking statistical hypotheses, the test is going to be based on our observed or sample values. And so we may or may not be right in whatever decision we make. And what we've been doing this lecture to some extent and last lecture is trying to quantify what's the likelihood of us being right or not. Okay. Now, if you make a hypothesis and then make a decision based on the hypothesis, there's four possibilities. Well, in reality, the hypothesis is either true or false. And then based on our decision, we decide whether it's true or false. So if it's true, we decide it's true, so we don't reject it. We decide it's false, we reject it. Okay. And as you can see, sometimes we're right. Sometimes the hypothesis was true, and we decided it was true. We're happy. Sometimes the hypothesis was false, and we actually decided it was false. But we also have two cases where we made the wrong decision. In one case, the hypothesis was true, but we decided to reject it. And that's what's called a type 1 error. In the other case, the hypothesis was false, and we decided to accept it. That's a type 2 error. Now, if you think back to the chi-square test, and you know, our examples of clearly non-random numbers, what we made there was a type 2 error. The numbers weren't uniformly distributed, but we decided based on the chi-square test that they were. Okay. So why did we do that? Okay, so then we have to get into what does a significance level mean. And a significance level is the probability of making a type 1 error. Okay, so it's the probability of rejecting our hypothesis when it's actually true. Okay. So it doesn't say anything about the probability of accepting a hypothesis when it's actually false, which is, again, the error we made. Okay. So, in an ideal world, what we have is two hypotheses where If we accept one, we reject the other, and if we accept the other, we reject one. And what's nice about that? Well, what's nice about that is the type 1 errors of one hypothesis are the type 2 errors of the other, and the type 2 errors of the one hypothesis are the type 1 errors of the other. So, if we could test both of our hypotheses for type 1 errors, we'd have everything covered. We could fully reason about the probability of making a mistake. The problem is, in general, we don't have tests for our alternative hypotheses. Okay. So, again here, our hypothesis was our underlying distribution is uniform. The opposite of that, which is called H1, is our underlying distribution is not uniform. Now, if you think about it, that one's going to be hard to try and prove. I would venture impossible. Okay. So, in a lot of cases, we are left with the situation where we can test for type 1 errors, but we can't test for type 2 errors. And so we make our decisions based on the probability of type 1 errors and then just hope like crazy that we don't have a high probability of type 2 errors. Again, that's, if you look at the chi-square test alone, that's not necessarily that great assumption, although people do sort of, again, typically get on with just applying chi-square tests and hoping, again, that some of these other structural problems aren't going to occur. Okay. So just to wrap up, if we look at our chi-square test, again, our null hypothesis is that the sample values have a certain distribution, and with the where the distribution is whatever we're trying to compare the samples to. Our reverse hypothesis, H1, is that they do not have that distribution. Our test is, for a given significance level, compare our calculated chi-square value to the critical value. And so we can make the decision to reject our hypothesis if the chi-square value is greater than the critical value. Okay, so that's what we did in the second example where we were calculating something with a non-uniform distribution. We decided to reject the hypothesis that the thing was actually exponentially distributed. And again, we have solid mathematical footing for doing this. Our significance level is giving us the indication of what's our probability of being wrong about that. Okay, so if we choose 5%, 1%, you're pretty confident that the rejection decision is not wrong. But the way we're using the chi-square test is we calculate that value, and for a given significance level, we make the comparison. And if the chi-squared value is less than that critical value, we accept our hypothesis. Okay. And the bottom line to that is it's done, and it actually does, it gives you some measure of confidence because you are sort of, you're getting some measure of how close it is. But it's not, again, the significance level is not meaningful in terms of gaining confidence about the acceptance of this hypothesis. Okay. So we've essentially done a test, but in terms of acceptance, the significance level isn't really giving us any confidence about whether we should really be accepting it. It's more like, you know, if we reject, we're sure about that decision. If we accept, we really just don't have enough information. Okay. Now, we deal with this situation because we know that, sort of from an intuitive point of view, that number is still measuring in some way how close you are to the expected values. And so it is giving you, you know, the smaller that number it is, it's giving you some degree of assurance that, you know, your distribution isn't too unreasonable. But it's not sort of, again, you can't really sort of assert anything mathematically. Okay, so we've looked at input modeling in terms of trying to fit sample values to distributions using the chi-square test. And again, it's a good place to start. You know, whether you stop there or not depends on sort of exactly what degree of confidence you require. But it is, again, it's one of the more common tests that would be used for these purposes. Okay, so that's the end of the lecture portion. I am hoping that the demonstrator will be here shortly. Whoops, actually. Let's see. Passing that because that might be him. Okay, so the demonstrator should be here in a few minutes. I suggest that we take about a 10-minute break, and then we will continue on with, Daniele will talk to you about the assignment, and hopefully he'll give you. If you've thought about it, then feel free to ask him sort of specific questions if you're having specific problems. Otherwise, if you're just getting started, hopefully it'll point you in the right direction. So I'll see you all again in maybe 10 or so minutes. Hopefully he'll be there.
I guess there's maybe a fault in the subject. Regarding the exponential equation.